The following podcast of the 2021 State of the University Address at Dominican University of California is made possible through the joint effort of the Office of the President, the Communication and Media Studies Department, and Penguin Radio.
Good morning and a warm welcome to the President's State of the University Address. It is my inordinate pleasure to welcome you all, whether you're a familiar face here in Angelico Concert Hall or joining us from the Caluega Plaza, where you can hear the event via audio stream, or are at home listening to our live broadcast on Penguin Radio. Welcome to you all. I'd also like to acknowledge the several trustees that are joining us remotely and extend a welcome to them as well. It's been about a year and a half since we gathered for an event of this scope. At a minimum, we are shaped, and I think even recast, by the gravity of what we've experienced. Losses, big and small, and also some of the gains of the past year. At the same time, I have to admit that today feels, for me, reminiscent of those first days of primary school when I experienced the nervousness of returning to school, along with the delight in renewing my friendships, and what I couldn't put in those terms to myself at that time, renewal of community and building community and that circle again. I fervently hope that this year will hold many good things for us all. While I know that, should that not be the case, we will do everything we can to address any and all obstacles and adversities meaningfully and collaboratively together. Today, it's also my pleasure to introduce the new faculty to you. And as you've heard in previous years, please hold your applause until all the names are read aloud. The new full-time faculty are, in the School of Liberal Arts and Education, Amy Backus, Richard Carolyn, and Gwendolyn Sanders. In the Borowski School of Business, they are Adam Browse, Daniel Roxbury, Mitchell Hudson, Daniel Morse, and Yi Zhang. We also have new adjunct faculty that we welcome to our ranks. In the School of Health and Natural Sciences, they are Charlotte McPherson, Jenica Jade Cruz Ocampo, Haley Lomheim, Hsing Ching Kua, Jacob Edward Everhard, James Engel, Jennifer Verling Chung, Lynn Noyce, Mary Murphy, Sarah Rossi, Shannon Gifford, and Stephanie Gail Buat. In the Borowski School of Business, we welcome Kenneth DeJarnett, and in the School of Liberal Arts and Education, Kimberly Sagebeal and Nathaniel Klug. Dear faculty colleagues, whether you're here or listening to me elsewhere, welcome to Dominican. It is now my pleasure to introduce our Interim Vice President for Finance and Administration, Bob Height. Bob, I'm going to say a couple of words about you, is a former Vice President at a number of Bay Area universities, including Golden Gate University, Menlo College, and Holy Names. We are thrilled to be able to draw on his expertise and wisdom, even if it's only for a short interim period. Delighted to have you here. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob Height.
Thank you, Mojgan, and welcome to everybody. I will just make a couple of brief comments before I introduce the new staff. I am very delighted to be here at Dominican. I am so grateful for the staff who report directly to me and the other staff I've met around campus, and am constantly impressed with the beauty of this place. The buildings like this one, and just the campus in general. Closer? Good. Yeah, and I'm not used to this either, so bear with me a little bit. So now it's my honor to introduce new employees, staff employees here at Dominican, and welcome them. And I would also ask that you hold applause until I complete all of the names. So, in admissions, and I hope I don't mispronounce this, Tuvshinzaya Erdenbatter. And I hear that she goes simply by Zaya. In advancement, Lanice Smith. In athletics, there are quite a few here. Justin Argonol, Lucas Bailden, Scott Davis, Stephen DeHart, Robert Grove, Joseph Mana, and Ricardo Martin. In the Borowski School of Business, Kalina Findlay. My glasses are starting to fog up, so I may have difficulty reading some of these names. In Information and Technology Services, Alan Siegel. In the School of Liberal Arts and Education, Julia Hoyt. In the School of Health and Natural Sciences, Lori Friedman, Sharon Freiberg, Vincent Goh, and Renee Lucha. And finally, in the Student Success Center, there's Helen Kennedy and Matthew Mueller. Welcome all of you to Dominican, and I look forward to meeting some of you. And now I would, I'm pleased to introduce Brandon Bolter, who is our interim vice president for enrollment and marketing.
Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to be here in person. I'm super excited to be reporting on fall 2021 enrollment. Not only the numbers, but the characteristics of the class coming in. You know, after a challenging fall 2020, really for all of us, and of course our enrollment last year, the Enrollment Marketing Division went to work with many of you, including our academic colleagues and other departments, to really make a meaningful impact in reaching out to prospective students. The marketing department launched various undergraduate, graduate, and adult degree completion advertising campaigns. You may have seen some in Google Ads or banner ads on the web. You may have seen them, you may have seen social media ads, or if you were unfortunate enough to fall behind a bus, you may also have noted some of the print ads that we had displayed in the community. We've grown our social media presence by 37% on Instagram, 45% on LinkedIn, and 3% on Facebook. Our communications team focused on growing Dominican's brand locally and nationally, with tantalizing student, alumni, and faculty stories that displayed the heart and resolve of our institution to the world to see. It's not only the hundreds of phone calls that each ambassador and admissions counselor has made to prospective students, not the thousands of admissions records entered into Slate, but also the efforts of faculty willing to try something new to attract a new generation of student to their program through unorthodox recruiting channels. Let's not forget the tireless efforts of our financial aid colleagues in working to meet the needs of a growing number of those affected by income inequality. Once again, over 90% of students are receiving some form of financial aid. Together, we've realized great success over the past year. We've seen an increase of 24% in submitted first-year applications, an 18% increase in deposits, an 11% increase in enrollment. Similarly, our graduate enrollment funnel is experiencing year-over-year growth, most notably a 20% increase in submitted applications, 19% increase in deposits, and 15% increase in enrollment. We continue our work with our academic colleagues in ramping up enrollment and marketing for new programs, including the new MS in accounting, the China MBA, and even onboarding the art therapy master's and PhD programs from NDNU. And let's not forget, most recently, our applied computer science program. Our top undergraduate majors this fall include nursing, biology, business, psychology, and dance. The ethnicity of our entering first-year class is as follows: 34% Asian, 33% Latinx, 20% white, 5% multi-ethnic, and 4% African-American. The average high school GPA is 3.7. And interestingly enough, we have students coming from 13 different countries, including Canada, Mexico, Brazil, Spain, Ethiopia, Guatemala, Hong Kong, India, Italy, Russia, Pakistan, South Africa, and Singapore. We have 36 first-year student athletes joining us, and I have to thank the coaches for their tireless efforts in making that process as enjoyable as possible. 76% of our first-year students will be living on campus, 15% will be living with parents, and 9% living off campus. And I have to thank our colleagues in student and academic affairs for supporting those students in making the transition, again, as seamless as possible. Excuse me. I think it's also important to note that this new incoming class is different. Remember, it's been, for many of them, a year and a half since they were in a setting like this. How wonderful is it to bring them to a beautiful campus like this, to have such a magnificent experience at a magnificent institution like Dominican University of California? There's so much more I could say, but not today. We have a lot of data. And so I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to our next speaker, who really needs no introduction, Paul Rocanello, Vice President for Student Affairs and Dean of Students.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. First off, a big, great big welcome to our new and returning Penguins who arrived early. Our student athletes, I think our women's soccer team is right here in the middle. Welcome back, ladies. If you see them limping, it's because they did not follow the workout program that Coach Coffey assigned them over the summer, and you know, that's what happens. Our student leaders in ASDU are in the middle of training. Our peer mentors are in the middle of training right now. Our Torch program participants just wrapped up, I think either last night or first thing this morning. So there are already quite a few students back on campus, and we are incredibly excited to see them here. A big thank you and shout out to the Student Life staff, especially the dynamic duo of Jessica Frazier and Aaron Clark, who have pulled together during the midst of all this chaos and confusion, an incredible orientation program that's going to be a very exciting start to our new students' Dominican experience. You will see much, yes, thank you. Yes, applause break. You'll see much activity and energy on campus the next few days, including food trucks, and I think Jessica sent out some information about that, so please do get in line behind the students. And there will be a carnival happening in the coming days. So those of you who love the Tilt-A-Whirl, knock yourselves out. It's not Tilt-A-Whirl, but it's something like that. So yeah, it's crazy. Mary Spike signed off, we're good. All right. I want to, in line with what Brandon said about students coming back for the first time in a year and a half, I want to recognize that this return to campus is a cause for both excitement for many of our students and much trepidation for other students. I ask our colleagues here that you show patience and grace with our students as they are either bouncing off walls because they're incredibly happy to be here, or a little bit nervous and apprehensive about coming back in community. And please extend support and guidance to them whenever you can. That would be most appreciated. In that vein, a special acknowledgement to the care team, to the integrative coaches, and to most especially University Counseling Services for their outstanding service to students this past year, being virtual with very few students on campus, and most especially for the incredible work they're going to be doing this coming year. It goes without saying, but are the number of care reports and clients referred to University Counseling Services continues to grow significantly every year. But the services and the support that is provided to those students is absolutely incredible, and I really want to thank those groups. As a reminder, if you are encountering a student who is having difficulties or needs support, dominican.edu/care team, submit the report. Within 24 to 48 hours, someone will reach out and get connected with that student. So thank you all for being here. Looking forward to welcoming our students back. And with that, I would like to introduce Marley Norris, our Vice President for Advancement and Public Health, Public Affairs, pardon me.
Toughest spot in the lineup following Paul Racanello. Hello, campus colleagues. Like all of you, Advancement and Alumni Relations wondered what our work would be like last year. I mean, how can you make a Zoom reunion meaningful? How do you ask for a major gift when you can't look a donor in the eyes? How do you keep people excited and engaged in the university's work? Well, I am so grateful to my team for their hard work and their creativity over these last 15 months. In the last fiscal year, our donors gave just over $2.5 million to Dominican University. In case you were wondering what those donors were supporting, it's not going to be a surprise after hearing Brennan speak. 32% of that money went to student aid and scholarships. About 21% went to the Dominican Fund, which is our unrestricted fund. That money can be put wherever it's needed most. 15% to academic programs, and then the balance to facilities, athletics, community programs like Ollie, and student life. I wanted to give one sort of quick example of what donor money can do. Most of you are familiar with the Close the Gap scholarship. That helps juniors and seniors who need a little bit of a financial boost to get to the finish line and complete their degrees. Since it was established in March 2016, Dominican has awarded 82 Close the Gap scholarships, totaling just over $272,000. 100% of those Close the Gap recipients have successfully graduated or are on track to graduate. I also want to thank all of you for helping out with the All In for Dominican Week, virtual as it was. We had some of our best numbers yet. 689 donors gave $187,000. So thank you for that. Like everyone, we hope that the coming year inches a little bit closer to normal. We are really looking forward to welcoming alumni and friends back in person. And now the main event. It is my pleasure to welcome to the stage, for the very first time, President Nicola Pitchford.
Hi, welcome. Welcome everyone. Bienvenidos a todos. It is such a pleasure to be here, just to be here in person, and to see a reasonable number of others able to do the same, and to know that we have several dozen colleagues listening at the same time, thanks to Penguin Radio, to Stuart Horn, I think Brad Van Alstine's assisting also. I also want to start by thanking those in the president's office who have helped set up the event, Jen Krangle, Jamie Libby, and Sandy Pearson. Thank you very much. And I want to thank the members of our grounds crew for providing the beautiful plants, for loaning them to us. Miguel, thank you very much. And my thanks to Puck for giving me a really nurturing canine greeting as we started. So I think Moshkan started by noting also what a strangely ambivalent time this is. A lot of reasons for joy and excitement and hope, not just the usual seasonal excitement and hope that come always with the start of a new school year, when I think for most of us our nerves are always alight. I never stopped having those weird nightmares before the first day of class. I'm relieved to find I am not in fact naked. There's also a deeper than usual joy at being able to be together again, although it's not straightforward, I know. Still, you can see when you turn to the person next to you whether they're smiling under their mask. There's a lot of gratitude, a lot of kindness in the air, and that's something that we can transmit to one another safely, even when wearing masks. But a lot of us are tired, too. Tired in a way that we wouldn't normally expect to be in August, at the end of a summer of slower or more reflective work time, of vacations with family, time for renewal. We're tired, tired of uncertainty, of being vigilant, of feeling vulnerable, tired of being afraid for ourselves and our loved ones. Tired of not knowing whether the institutions we depend on will, in fact, take care of us, look out for us. Tired of worrying about whether we or our partners might lose our jobs. Tired of making ends meet on less. Maybe we're tired of social division, of everyone being angry all the time, of what we perceive to be astounding stupidity or hate. Here at the university itself, we're tired of austerity, of a budget deficit that just won't go away. For some of us, we've never had the assurances that institutions would look out for us. We've never had the assurances that a stranger approaching us might not be a danger to us. And we may be tired or bitter at having others discover what have been our life experiences. For those of us who have long been confined to our homes, not able to enjoy without obstacle the pleasures of public space, we too may be a little bitter at having others discover what that's like. And for all of us, being unable to see loved ones in faraway places, let's think about all the people scattered across the world and the increasing number of unhoused and refugee people who are not able to visit or know the whereabouts even of those they love. And we're missing people. Coming together is part of the process of mourning. If you're missing somebody you lost over the last year, 2 years, I'm really sorry. Here at the university, we are missing Father Bob Haberman. We are missing John Kennedy. We're missing Joseph Fink, the 8th president of Dominican. Or maybe like me, you're just missing someone precious whom you haven't been able to be with because of travel restrictions and fears. Maybe someone whose time left feels awfully finite. I'm sorry. We also miss the Dominican faculty and staff who aren't physically with us in the room right now, and those few who will need to continue to be remote this year because of particular vulnerabilities. Although I hope that they're joining us virtually via Penguin Radio, and that most of us can break bread together safely outdoors shortly after I'm done. As usual, the peril of standing between you and food. So normally the State of the University Address is a time for celebration, and we've been marking a number of things to celebrate today, and I'm grateful to the vice presidents for sharing those important things with us. We celebrate the joy and hope of new beginnings every year, and of course it's a particularly new beginning for me. While I've been at Dominican for 10 years, this is my first State of the University Address as president. But I hardly need to tell you that the world is on fire out there. We've failed one another and ourselves in many ways. I'm already tired of my own generation and what we've done to the world, what we are handing on to the next generations. There's a profound and urgent climate emergency, an emergency of natural resources. It's predicated on two other emergencies, emergencies of social inequity, the crisis of systemic racism, of white supremacy is far from new, but it's grown so acute and so violently visible in this country that not even the most complacent can pretend at this point innocence as individuals or as institutions.
and systemic racism goes hand in hand with other exclusions and forced invisibilities of LGBTQ people, of disabled people, of the neurodivergent. And meanwhile, the third crisis, the grotesque disparities between rich and poor, grow more brutal and pronounced by the day, globally, nationally, and here in Marin, which has one of the widest gaps between rich and poor in the entire country, and has the widest gap by race in the state of California. And the racialized wealth gap is being both worsened by the pandemic and also itself aggravating and spreading the pandemic. The increasingly bimodal distribution of wealth in the US impacts higher education very directly, as we see fewer and fewer families able to afford college, and a thinning tax base and hostile climate around public funding of higher ed that means less and less of the cost is being covered by federal and state dollars. During the pandemic, how many times did you find yourself thinking, when things get back to normal? But normal is broken in many ways. A lot of us have also spent time in the lockdown hoping that things will not get back to normal when this is all over, vowing to change things, whether in our own lives, in our world, or both. Honestly, I look at that vast trailing history of injustice and violence behind us. I look at how many of our institutions are not, in fact, failing, but are functioning exactly as designed to benefit the few at the expense of the many. And many days, I want to burn it all down and just start over. It doesn't feel like a world that's built to prioritize love or caring or joy. Every institution needs to examine itself critically right now. It feels like a time also for Dominican to change, as solid as we may be, and as much work as we have done and do to build a loving community every day. We're making it through the pandemic. People are being amazing. And let me just shout out to the pandemic response team. Marley Norris, who has been leading and convening that team, working literally 7 days a week, and everyone who serves. Those who are in the room, would you stand up? And those on Calarega Plaza, would you make yourselves known to your colleagues? Amid all this, you're not just keeping on teaching and working and studying and sustaining your life outside Dominican in your families. You're doing more and more. You're launching new programs. You're creating new support structures to help students not fall by the wayside, not slip through the cracks in such a challenging environment. You're becoming amateur public health experts. You're serving on the pandemic response team and the HOPE team. You're adapting to a new wave of Title IX regulations and international travel restrictions, and upgrading our campus HVAC to comply with health and safety best practices, and onboarding Make School students who didn't expect to be here this fall. You're doing more and more. And it's all really important, and I'm so grateful. But I think for a lot of us, it does feel pretty unsustainable. And it still doesn't seem like enough to ensure that Dominican really thrives for the long term. We struggle to meet our enrollment goals despite the best and continually adapting skills of our admissions staff, our coaches, our faculty who work with them. And we struggle sometimes to grow programs that we know are high quality and have plenty of space. I think we all just want to be sure that Dominican will be here next year and next decade and for the long haul for all of us and to build our future. That is my responsibility more than anyone else's, except perhaps Dr. Klebanoff and the members of our all-volunteer board of trustees who care for the long-term future of the institution centrally. I want our work and this institution to become truly sustainable, and that does mean more change. The good news is that we've done a lot of crucial work already. Because of the strategic thinking and design work we've undertaken with President Marcy's incredible leadership over the last 10 years, to identify and articulate a clear vision and a specific position in the higher ed landscape for what Dominican does. I think we have a much stronger collective sense than when I first came here of who we are and what our fundamental direction is. We have three really strong anchors. There is our mission, which affirms belief in a liberal education grounded in ethics and beauty and global responsibility and kinship in the arts, humanities, sciences, and professions alongside one another and cross-fertilizing one another, and in serving a genuinely diverse student body that incorporates many students from previously underrepresented and excluded populations. There is also the 800-year-old Dominican model of education, which we inherit from the care of the Dominican sisters, which insists that study must be connected to reflection, community, and service. And third, there's the contemporary expression of that educational model in the Dominican experience. To remind you, or for our newer colleagues or students, we developed the Dominican experience and have evolved it together because its four elements bring together study, reflection, community, and service in ways that really work for the students we have today. The high-impact practices built into the Dominican experience have been shown to improve learning outcomes and a sense of post-college life fulfillment for all students across demographics, and particularly to reduce equity gaps for previously underrepresented students. It's really authentic to who we are and helps us to do right by all students. So our mission, the Dominican values, and the Dominican experience are our North Stars. They are really good guides for where we will need to go. But I think there's still work we need to do to make sure that everything we do, our being in the world as a university, responds to the crises and imperatives of the world around us, our community, our students' community. I've been thinking of this as deep sustainability. Deep sustainability, our long-term sustainability as a university, means that at its heart, our work must stand as an ethical response to a climate and natural resource emergency, to entrenched and systemic racial inequity, and to increasing economic disparities and inequality. And consistent with our mission, that means both locally and globally. These are the challenges of our time. If we're going to thrive and endure, all we can do is do what we believe is the right thing for our students, to eliminate the obstacles to their being here, and to help equip them for these challenges, and to have faith that that will matter. I don't have answers to what this future change will look like in practice. I have ideas, of course, but I hope this feels like something worth working for together. I'm reminded of a poem by, you knew there was going to be a poem, right? I was an English professor. I'm reminded of a poem by Wendell Berry, the writer, environmental activist, farmer, and professor, our real work. It may be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. And that when we no longer know which way to go, we've come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Our real work. Let's talk about work. Deep sustainability sounds like a lot of work, and you've been doing a lot of work. I can imagine you may not be thrilled to have me and Wendell announce that we've now come to our real work. You may not feel entirely like a stream that sings. You may feel less like a slightly impeded stream than like a dam. One of our sustainability problems is that we've been working as hard as we can and being asked to do more and being asked to do more again. I can speak only from what I see, and a president's view of the university is a very limited one. But I do want to say that first, I feel like I have the best possible people around me to do this work. In my office and in every school and every building of this campus, and on the lawns in between, and at every meeting of the Board of Trustees. I'm surrounded by people who awe me all the time with how much smarter they make me when I talk to them, how much delight they make me feel about what we're doing, how important our students are to all of us. People at Dominican are amazing. But I also return to the awareness that a lot of us are tired, from vice presidents to grounds crew to faculty to data managers to coaches. Our jobs have just been expanding and expanding, and we've been taking on more new initiatives, and there never seems to be more money to support that work. In fact, there's usually less. And a lot of people's salaries have not gone up for a long time and don't feel livable in the Bay Area or even fair. And it's always going to be better next year, and then it isn't. I think for quite a few people on campus, the way we're working, again, does not feel sustainable. I've been thinking about this a lot. I've been reading and thinking about how we might work differently together, and also asking others to tell me what they would identify as some of our organizational and work culture challenges. I want to hear from you about that. The cabinet spent a lot of our recent retreat focusing on this. Low salaries are certainly one of the things making work feel unsustainable, and I'm most concerned about those that are not only comparatively low, but absolutely low in terms of the Bay Area. Other organizational and work culture challenges include a lack of trust and a lack of transparency, a lack of understanding of others' roles, what others do at the university, a sense of disempowerment and disenfranchisement of not being heard, a lack of clarity about decision-making authority and responsibility, or over-complexity in our decision-making processes, technological systems that don't support the shape of our work, and a perceived lack or failure of communication, a problem that strangely is not solved by more meetings, or for that matter, more emails. And none of this is because of bad people, for sure. I'm not even sure it's because of bad management. A lot of it's aggravated also by the sustained austerity in which we've been working. But it does need to change. It hampers our ability to thrive and certainly throttles our ability to make change. So this is about sustainability too. In terms of workload, sustainability has to mean doing less. I have a farmer friend who spends his life thinking about sustainability. And I can just hear the laughter of people who know me best. They're like, oh, we knew this was coming. He's written a couple of amazing books about it. His name is James Rebanks. He's also been my writing teacher and mentor. Rebanks tends a small farm in the tough and beautiful hills of the northwest England in the Lake District, on land where his family's lived for hundreds of years. It's a mixed subsistence farm, suited more to grazing than to growing crops. He rears mostly sheep, a few cattle, pigs, chickens. He writes about the history of the place and the people who have worked this land over centuries, and about its nature and its landscape now. And he writes urgently about environmental sustainability, although he doesn't use that language very much. Rebanks tells the story of how farming was transformed in his grandfather's and particularly his father's time. It's a story much of which would be equally familiar in the American Midwest, or even in California's Central Valley. He writes about the advent of the first gas-powered machinery after the Second World War, particularly tractors and plows, and then the transformative introduction at scale of artificial fertilizers and pesticides. They revolutionized the small farms in the area. Suddenly, one man could do the work of six or 10 scrubby corners of the fields that had always been left to weeds or bog since time immemorial could be drained, cleared, and planted without the back-breaking labor required previously. Fields that were good only for sheep grazing or that had to lie fallow for seasons at a time to regenerate the soil naturally could now be refertilized immediately and crop farmed year-round. Enormous productivity was promised. Instead of every farmer having to do a tiny bit of everything in case one thing failed, sheep, a few cattle, chicken, pigs, a vegetable field, a few acres of potatoes or wheat, they could simplify and specialize and grow to great scale since labor needs were so reduced. The traditional stone walls and thick hedges of the small higgledy-piggledy fields were torn down to create large, rectangular, regular-shaped fields needed to plow or harvest efficiently at scale. Herds expanded. Farms consolidated into mega-farms. Yet so much was lost when everything was sacrificed to the great god of efficiency. Young people left the farms and villages where their work was no longer needed, went to the cities and towns, never came back. Older farmers sold out, retired to the coast maybe. Their lifetimes of knowledge of place and ecosystem were lost. The remaining farmers got deeply into debt to invest in competitive machinery, chemicals, and continually improved seeds or animals that then required further investment in veterinary treatment and medicines because they may be more meat-rich or milk-rich than the traditional local breeds, but they're also less hardy. And the farms are then caught in a cycle of having continually to expand in order to meet their debt payments. There's no stasis in this model, which relies on constant increases in scale and efficiency. And the birds and wild animals, the wild grasses and wildflowers suddenly disappeared from the land. The biodiversity plummeted. The sky fell silent. The streams straightened for greater water flow and irrigation were emptied of fish. Floods and landslips kept happening on a scale never before seen. Not far away, the moorland caught on fire. Rebanks writes about the ground nesting birds, the plovers and curlews, that used to thrive on his grandfather's land, about the robin's nests and badger's burrows that were concealed and safe in the tangles of brambles in inaccessible field corners or thick hedgerows. He writes about the abandoned stone cottages on the hillsides or those converted to holiday homes used only 1 month a year by the urban middle class, where once there had been a settled community. And above all, about the uncanny silence. I'm telling this story as a parable, of course, for us, for Dominican. We know we are a small subsistence university, where unique beauty is fostered that might be overlooked in a place with more efficiency and scope and space. We know, for instance, that students from underrepresented and under-resourced backgrounds are far more likely to graduate here, to complete degrees in 4 years or 6 years, than they would be at a place with the scale of Sonoma State or Cal State East Bay. Like Rebanks's father, we have struggled to achieve some economies of scale, and we've had some success in our growth. But now we feel pressures of continual expansion, of a perpetual growth model. Most of us feel we could constantly use another staff position in our unit for all the work, even though we know we can't compete with larger universities on that sense of scale. We also see clearly that our student population as a whole is not going to grow a great deal. The student population in the state and the country is not growing. Indeed, it is declining. It's shrinking, and it's fragmenting into more specialized and differentiated types of student. Economies of scale will not save us. Sustainable diversification is how to protect what's precious to us. Stay small, stay personal, stay beautiful, deep sustainability. It's hard work. James Rebanks and his wife Helen and their four children all have work to do every day. The children, even the smallest, have their own chickens, lambs, cattle, and they still don't make ends meet on farming alone. They've had to, as we say, diversify their revenue streams by securing government grants, hosting school events, summer camps, sustainability workshops, and in James's case, by writing and environmental consulting. We know the situation. But they've restored the farm, and it's beautiful. The streams have been re-wiggled from their artificial straight channels. They are full of fish and no longer flood regularly. They sing. There are rabbits and hares and foxes and badgers and relayed hedgerows, and among the hundreds of new trees in the woods, one of which I planted, where the cattle can shelter on summer days without needing a great corrugated iron and breeze block building. And the endangered ground birds, the curlews, can be heard again in the fields. I'm actually talking about strategic planning in a way. We have our key principles and strengths, our North Stars. We know who we are, what we're good at. But how we operate doesn't seem to me to be focused fully on enabling us to be our most fulfilled. and to extend our best thinking towards serving our students in a world that is on fire. Maybe that's not so much a strategic planning challenge as a matter of rethinking our work culture and our service culture. That can only be done through collective wisdom. I'll do my best to make space for it, to insist on transparency and generosity with information as the default for the university, and to focus on raising funds to support it. To you, Dominican faculty and staff, I want to ask a question that's grown out of the wisdom of generations of community and labor organizing here in the US. To make things better here, what are you willing to work for? What are you willing to work on? I don't want to tell you. Let me frame that a little more. I think we can work differently, both faculty and staff. One of the principles of more inclusive and supportive workplaces is horizontality across functions. That means working in loose teams of people at a similar level, faculty or staff or both, across different units. Not at a supervisor's behest or direction, but to start from your view of the student experience and how better to support it. To improve it by working together on problem solving or processes or projects that belong in no single unit or department. I'd like to see such teams have the authority to decide on solutions and changes, including changes that need to be presented to other units or teams in order for them to really be operationalized. This goes hand in hand with the idea of upward delegation or reverse delegation. Instead of me or your dean or vice president naming the strategic planning areas or topics we need to focus on and assembling a task force to make recommendations upward on each topic, teams would decide which topics can't be solved at the frontline level and push those upward to ask our help to address them. Whenever possible, I think we could work this way, meeting informally or formally as needed in teams, perhaps briefly, but frequently, mostly to keep focused as obstacles arise, instead of meeting in standing committees and departmental units quite so often. A lot of our meeting structures and even our formal governance structures are set up because we just don't communicate well otherwise. And people who need to be consulted or informed aren't consulted or informed unless they get themselves put on that committee. But then the committee can't actually make decisions until they've gone right up the chain of other committees or governance bodies and VPs to the president, maybe to the board, and we've accepted their recommendations. And it still never feels like we're communicating effectively or that we know what others are actually doing. And faculty or staff working in their departments or units can't make decisions to change things without making sure they've talked to everybody else and they've been through the right committees. And for good reason, because all of our actions here do impact others' work. But I think if we could build more transparency and trust and know that all of us are focused on putting students' experience first as the driver of our work, we maybe wouldn't need so many meetings to make sure everyone was fully consulted. Let's trust each other a bit more to do productive things. I'm not, by the way, suggesting eliminating formal governance or formal governance committees, far from it, but I hope that this way of working might strengthen formal governance by focusing on its areas of real authority rather than trying to make it serve as a substitute for functioning communication. So I return to the question, what are you willing to work on? What are you willing to work for? What would work for you? We could have a workplace where that really could be your decision, and where everyone was really working for the same core values and priorities, but along different tracks. And it does start with centering students, as well as resisting actively the tremendous inertia of doing things the way we've done things in the past. Systems have such a weighty desire to return to immediate equilibrium, the tyranny of the habitual and the familiar. Let's look at our students and ask how we could do things differently. There's a lot to follow up on here, and I promise we will, unless people find no value in approaching things this way as a route toward deep sustainability, in which case we will collectively work out how to do it differently. Finally, I heard an interviewer ask James Rebanks recently, well, what should we as individuals do about climate crisis? About sustainability And of course, there were things like buy organic, locally sourced food if you can afford it, lobby for fresh food in under-resourced neighborhoods, write to your elected representatives. But he also said, I'd just like everyone to grow something. Maybe a vegetable patch if you have a garden, maybe just one tomato plant on your windowsill. Just something that you have to care for a little bit every day and watch and get to know what its needs are. And the equivalent to me is that all of us, faculty and staff, should make sure we're talking to students or prospective students every single working day. And that includes me. Absolutely. I know it's not a challenge for faculty, or in some ways it's the challenge. But for the rest of us, including me, let's make sure we build time in our days intentionally every day to talk to students, to listen to students. They are, forgive me, students, our precious biodiversity, our sometimes frustratingly non-uniform and unique and fruitfully unchanneled complex fragments of ecosystem. And when we can support one another in an atmosphere of trust and creative problem solving, when we can actually do less, we will thrive. Thanks for giving me a chance. Let's see how it goes.